So if you recall from last time, we were beginning this series of lectures on human factors in architecture. And last time we were talking about the propensity of human beings to designate and organize uses, to figure out, these are the things I'm doing in my life, this is where I'm going to do this, this is where I'm going to do this, this is the relationship between this and this, I'm going to make the right proximity, I'm going to get my life organized around space. And we looked at a whole range of examples, everything from the notion of Aborigines just designating, organizing use, and really not even building very much, to these 19th century houses by H.H. Richardson, where he really shaped the house around the lifestyle of the people that it was meant to be for, and very gracious, very well-defined notions of visitors and family and servants and everyone in the right relationship to each other to make the very most gracious and beautiful, affluent life. And then also these two libraries we looked at, more contemporary buildings that, again, take all the functions of a library and sort them out to make them work just exactly right. So I ask you in your Twitter card question to identify a building that you thought might have had that impetus as a generator for it. And we got some great responses, so here are a few. Someone says, a cruise ship is built like the homes from the 19th century. When you enter, you walk into a main lobby that is elaborately decorated. If you have more wealth, your room is on the upper floor, and vice versa if you do not. There are elevators just for crew members, so the passengers are not interrupted. Someone else says, my high school was a product of organization. It had four academic wings, each designated to a particular area of study, and then a central library in the middle. The library represented knowledge at the heart of the school. Each wing led to the library. Someone else says, houses in Cambodia often surround marketplaces and usually have their smaller dimension on the front despite being very long. This allows for more houses to open up shops around the market and is also convenient for customer viewing. Family spaces are therefore placed on the top floors, while the ground floor provides a place to display merchandise. Great observation. A couple here on the SAC. Someone says, the SAC is built based on the way each floor will be used. The bottom floor is a big open space where people will eat, talk, and interact with each other, while the middle floors are quiet areas where students can study, and the upper floors are classrooms where lectures are held and the academic departments are housed. Another one on the SAC, someone says, a great example would be the Student Activity Center on the campus. This building was designed completely for the students, with the ground floor as a place to study, hang out, and grab a bite to eat, while the upper floors are more private. Someone else says, a building that was built around designation and organization of use is my old high school. The school is formed around the central hub, which is the cafeteria and also the library. The entrances are very close to the hub, so it's very easy for students to congregate and for public meetings to be held. It is public in the center, but intimate as you reach the edges of the building. Then someone noted a failure in this regard. And this was an interesting observation. One non-example of a building organized by function is Gregory Gym. You have to walk all the way to the back just to get to the lockers before starting your workout. Wait, wouldn't you want to walk if you were going to get a workout? Well, whatever. So actually, there is a campus that was designed by Sprint, the telecommunications company, in Kansas, and they noted that all of their employees were getting kind of fat ass, you know? They were putting on a lot of weight. And so they actually designed their new campus with the parking garage a long way away from the buildings, so that at least every day the employees would be walking, and they made it a nice walk through gardens and trees and things like that to walk from the parking garage to sit on their ass all day staring at their computer while they worked. But it was intentional to improve the health of their employees. Okay, so today we're talking about architectural determinism. So, you know, early in the class, I told you this quotation from Winston Churchill, where he said, "We shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us." Wow, that's kind of a big, sweeping claim, that our buildings shape us. You're telling me that my character, my life is determined by those buildings? Wait, I thought I was in control here. You're telling me that these buildings actually shape me. And that's, we talked at that in that same lecture about this recent book by David Eagleman, a neuroscientist, called Incognito, where he talks about how so much of our behavior, so much of our life is run by our unconscious brain, not by our conscious brain. By reactions that we have, and we're not even thinking about it, but it's determining who we are, what we do, what our behavior is. So today we're interested in the degree to which this architectural determinism actually operates. How much of our behavior and our life is determined or affected strongly by buildings? So there has been, over the last maybe 50 years, a ton of work done in anthropology and sociology on this topic. And it started with a series of books that were done probably in the 1950s. And it started with a book that was called The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris. And this was an anthropologist who went to Africa and observed how primates live, how they form communities. And this was a brand new idea. We take it for granted now, but at that point, they just thought, animals are animals, humans are humans, no connection. But this is one of the first serious studies that began to see what parallels exist between primate behavior in apes and primate behavior in human beings. And so he was observing the way they form communities, the way they make friendships, the way they make clans, the way they organize themselves as communities. And in it, he pointed out that a whole lot of it is spatial. The way they organize themselves is by clusters of space. This territory is for one group. This territory is for another group. Then shortly afterward, another book came out called The Territorial Imperative by Robert Ardrey. And that one took this territoriality to another level and began to really see how primates, and he's studying actually apes again, but the implication is, well, wait, what about human beings? But how do we use space to organize our community, organize our family, relationships between mother and father and kids? How do we organize our clan, larger family groups? How do they organize larger societies, communities? How do they even sort of sort out, well, here are the chimpanzees, and here are the apes, and here are the gorillas, and what relationship do they have? How do they actually start to make peace with each other, reduce conflict by territorially locating themselves in various ways? And then a third book came out shortly after that that was called On Aggression, and it was by Conrad Lorenz. And that one really made the claim that the way that we sort out our aggressive side as primates is spatially. And this goes all the way to like freaking countries. I mean, we're seeing it right now with Crimea. At this macro scale, it is one society making a claim on space, territoriality, and saying this is us, instead of this being them. And that's the history of wars, it's the history of the world. at that macro scale, but it goes all the way down to the micro scale of, did you get along with your little sister? Or, you know, what kind of relationship did you have with your parents? All of these conflicts, potential conflicts, all of these connections, according to these observations of primates, are something that are just built into us, and that our behavior, our relationships with other people, are very much based on space and on territory. So there was a very serious study done at MIT in the 50s called Social Pressures in Informal Groups. It was done by two sociologists, one named Kurt Festinger and the other one named Jack Schachter. And these two guys were looking at a housing development that had just been put in at MIT. This was after World War II. There was a housing shortage in the Boston area. And so for MIT graduate students trying to find housing was very difficult. And there were a lot of GIs coming back from the war, and so they had a big influx of students. And so they took some old army barracks and they put them on Briggs Field, which had been a sports field, and temporarily put some housing in there. And then that temporary housing lasted for 10 or 15 years. But so Festinger decided that he would look at the social relationships in this graduate student housing that had been put there at MIT. And he thought this is a perfect instance because these are adult human beings, but they don't know each other by and large. And I'm curious about how they form social relationships with each other. Who do you become buddies with? Who do you hang out with? And this, of course, affects your life enormously, who your friends are, whether you're able to have good friendship formations, those kinds of things. So he's just going into this community. It's maybe 200, 250, and it's married students because they're a little more mature. Most of them had been off at the war and came back. So about 250 families that lived in this group, just mostly married students. So one premise was, well, maybe they will clump together by the discipline of whichever one of them is a student at MIT, so that maybe all the ones who are electrical engineers, they and their wives or husbands will clump together and they'll form social groups, or all the business students would be together, or all the chemists would be together. And so they did all these elaborate surveys and interviews, and they found, not really, no. They didn't tend to hang out with the people they saw in their academic life on the rest of the campus. No particular pattern there. So then they posited, well, maybe they'll go back to their state of origin. So these kids were from all over the country, you know, so would all the people from the Deep South who had a deep Southern drawl and talk funny, maybe they'd cluster together, and then all the Yanks would cluster together, and all the wild and crazy Californians would cluster together. And so they, you know, checked that. Not really. There wasn't any pattern of friendship formation according to origin or geography. But what was incredibly striking to them is the degree to which people formed friendships around space. And two different parameters there. One was physical distance, and one was functional distance. So this is the way these buildings were laid out. They were long, thin barracks buildings. There were 8 units on the top floor and 8 units on the bottom floor. All of them opened onto an open balcony on one side. And they were laid east-west, and the main MIT campus is to the east, and basically there's nothing to the west. So everybody's going to the MIT campus or to the bus or to the rest of the city going to the east. So a long building, 8 units on the top, 8 units on the bottom, and everybody's going that direction. So in terms of physical distance, they figured out that people tended to be friends with, the people who lived next door to them, right and left, the people who lived on their floor, or the people who lived in their building. So there would be 16 units in a building. You know, they tended to know that community of people, the people who were next door neighbors, the people who were on their floor, the people who are in their building. That's just physical distance. And the point is, people tend to have relationships with people, make friendships with people who are physically closer to them. And then the other one was functional distance. And this was really interesting. This is a dumb, simple little thing. But the person who lived in the apartment at the east end of the building, where there was a stair at each end of the hallway, and the one that lived by the stair at the east end of the building, they knew everybody on their floor, on that top floor, because everybody had to walk by their door to get to the campus. But the person who lived at the west end of the building, where nobody went that direction, they didn't know nearly as many people. They weren't as exposed to informal interaction with people, and therefore they had a harder time making friends. So the number of friendships with the person on the east side was about double the number of friendships of the person on the west end. Just the luck of the draw of which unit you got assigned to. That's functional distance, because as people walk that route as a functional part of their day, it makes a difference in terms of who you run into. And the people with the very most friendships were the ones who lived on the ground floor at the east end by the stairwell where the mailboxes were. Because people would tend to go to the mailbox, stand there, open their mailbox, read their mail a little bit there, and that person whose apartment was right there, if their door was open or if they were sitting out on their patio, they'd say, "Hi, how you doing?" And they'd strike up a friendship. And all 16 people in the building hung out by their apartment with some frequency. Whereas the guy on the top floor on the west end of the building, that was the least number of friendships in the building. Again, were these people conscious of that? Oh, shit, I got assigned on the top floor at the west end. I'm going to be lonely. Probably not. But unconsciously, all of these factors were working on their friendship formation. Okay, so that was an interesting study. And then, of course, there are other things besides just plan layout. There have been any number of studies in mental hospitals. Can you actually calm a schizophrenic by using certain colors in the physical environment? Can you calm a schizophrenic by making a simpler, more open environment as opposed to one that has odd shapes or twists or turns or is a little confusing? Can you actually alter people's psychological state by the physical environment? And again, yeah, those things tend to work. We talked earlier in the semester about the study by Lisa Hishong, whose book you just read, but she since then has done a lot of study on light, on daylight. And she looked at all these California schools and trying to see, do kids do better in schools with lots of daylight than in schools with very little daylight? And absolutely, that's the case. The test scores in both reading and in math improve more if you're in a classroom with abundant daylight as opposed to a classroom with very little daylight. And there's a scientific explanation for that, because our bodies tend to produce serotonin more if we're exposed to daylight. They produce it less if we're not exposed to daylight. Serotonin is that both a neurotransmitter, which is important for creating synaptic connections in your brain and actually learning. It also is an antidepressant. It makes you more alert. It makes you more accepting of information. So, of course, you would learn better if your body's producing more serotonin. If you have more daylight, your body's going to produce more serotonin. So it's not surprising that kids who were in a classroom with more daylight were learning faster. We talked also about this study by Roger Ulrich on hospital environments. Do people heal faster in some environments than they do in others? And I told you about this hospital with a double-loaded corridor, identical rooms on both sides, identical nurses and doctors and service on both sides. But on one side, the windows looked out into a blank brick wall 20 feet away. On the other side, the windows looked out to a beautiful garden with big trees and nice activity down there. And the people who were looking out to the garden, they received much less pain medication, They're requesting less pain medication. And they got out of the hospital faster than the people who were on the side that looked into the brick wall. All of this is evidence that, yes, the architectural environment, the way it's laid out, the way it's colored, the way it's shaped, the way you have views, the kind of light you get in there, all of those things actually, yes, determine our behavior, our health, our learning, our friendship formation, fundamentally what our life is like. So all of that's very interesting. There began to be then a projection to say, well, maybe we could use this as a social tool. We'll actually take bad social practices, a neighborhood that's got crime or a neighborhood that's got, you know, a lot of turmoil, a lot of conflict, and we'll redesign the physical environment and we'll cure that. We'll fix it. We'll make people behave themselves by putting them in a more appropriate physical environment. And in fact, in the 1960s, part of LBJ's Great Society was a huge amount of money the government was going to spend on what they called urban renewal, going into neighborhoods that were slums, going into neighborhoods that were high crime areas, and redesigning them so that then it would fix them and they wouldn't have this high crime or they wouldn't have all the social problems they were having. And so the federal government came in, bought large pieces of cities, completely redesigned those and said, you know, that we're going to fix that. But guess what? It didn't really work. Yes, there were some success stories, but sometimes they came in and built new housing and did it the best they thought they could do and, you know, moved the people back in. And first thing you know, they're stealing the copper from the plumbing to buy drugs, and they're, you know, putting graffiti on everything, and they're peeing in the stairwell, and they're thinking, what's wrong here? We were going to determine their behavior, and it was going to be right. There even was a book written in that era, a book called Defensible Space by Oscar Newman, and he swore that we could fight crime. We could make crime drastically reduced if we just made the physical environment right. And it was things like if you made it so when a family sent their kids out to play, that the mom could stand at the kitchen sink and see the playground. And if she could see the playground and she could supervise in that way, the kids tended not to get into as much trouble. And yeah, that was kind of true. Or if your car was parked in an area that you could see from your living room window, then there was less likelihood that that car would be stolen because the thief would come and realize, oh my God, all these people are looking at their cars here. I'm going to find some place to steal a car where I'm not seen that way. That you could use all of these little techniques in designing the physical environment to stop crime. And they did some of those, but you know, it didn't work 100%. So it began to make people question, can we actually shape people's behavior with the physical environment? Now, I want to be honest about this. Do I think that architecture determines behavior? You bet. Absolutely. I think there's incontrovertible evidence. Do I think it's a one-to-one thing? Can I make you behave a certain way by putting you in a certain environment? Probably not. It's more complicated than that. The physical environment can provoke certain behavior, but is it going to be 100% for everybody? No. The physical environment can limit certain behaviors, but is it going to be 100% for everybody? Probably not. So I'm going to suggest there is this kind of loose fit, not tight fit, but loose fit between physical environment and behavior, between architectural environment and how people live their lives. So I'm going to say that there are three different ways that we can look at that relationship between architecture and behavior. One is what I would call conforming use.
You design something for a conforming use. And you can pretty much predict that people will do what you designed it for if it's designed well. So we design a room as a bedroom, and we put certain accoutrements in it, and we put certain light qualities in it, and we put in a certain relationship to a bathroom or to a hallway. We give it a certain amount of privacy. We can be pretty sure that people are going to sleep there. That's conforming use. A second is what we might call implied use, that, you know, it's likely, it's suggested kind of by the space that that will take place there, but it might or it might not. It's implied in it. And then the third one is what we're going to call accommodated use, something that could happen. Maybe even the designer never would have predicted it, but the design actually accommodates that use perfectly well. So let me give a couple of examples here. Maybe let's think of the most specific, the most absolutely confining physical environment we can imagine designing. And let's look at it in those three terms. So I'm going to suggest that maybe that's a coffin. This is a very specifically designed architectural environment, a coffin. And its conforming use is for burying a dead body, right? I mean, its dimensions are exactly right for the depth of the body, the width of the body, the length of the body. So you design it exactly that way. You're going to bury this body. You don't want water seeping in, so there's a certain sort of watertight quality. You know, a coffin is designed very, very specifically for a conforming use to bury a dead body. But I would also say there are some implied uses in that too. So how many horror movies have you seen where a coffin is used? And often it's not used to bury a body, but that coffin may be used just to scare you. There's something frightening about that coffin. Or maybe they put somebody's live body inside a coffin and shut the door. You know, it's super confining, it's terrifying. So maybe there's an implied use of a coffin just by its design. It can be a scary environment, sort of claustrophobic and incredibly uncomfortable. So that's an implied use. That's by the nature of what the way it was designed. And then I would say there are maybe some accommodated uses for a coffin. So when you think about it, you know, a coffin could make a really, really nice planter box for flowers because the depth of it is about the right depth of soil you need for plants. And it's watertight, so you can water the plants and it's not all going to drain out. You know, there's enough mass of it. It can make a lovely sort of group of flowers there. You know, is that implied? Well, maybe not really, but it's accommodated. You could have a nice little flower bed inside a coffin. I heard a story one time about a guy who had a coffin made for him, a really rich guy. And he thought, you know, maybe my heirs are going to be cheap ass and they'll bury me in a pine box. I don't want that to happen. I want to get this really cool ass coffin. If I'm going to stay there for the ages, I want it to be really, really sweet. So he had it, you know, craftsmen carve the wood and, you know, beautiful lining out of elegant fabrics. And he had this whole coffin made. And then he, like, put it in his closet and thought, you know, when the time comes, hey, I'm prepared. But, you know, having it in his closet there kind of spooked him, kind of made him uncomfortable. He decided, I don't think I'm going to die for a while, so I don't want this thing around in my house. So he decided to get rid of the coffin. So he finds an antique dealer who sort of specializes in these very beautifully crafted wood things, and he says, tell you what, I'll give you this really cheap. So the antique dealer buys this coffin, this elaborate, beautiful coffin, and he puts it in his antique shop, and sure enough, Nobody's shopping for coffins in an antique store. So the thing just sits around for years and years. And then finally one day a young couple comes in and they say, gee, we're looking for a coffee table. You got a coffee table? And the antique dealer says, not really. But I have this coffin table, and it's about the length of your sofa, and it's about the right height to sit on the sofa and put your coffee or magazines on it. And it's really beautiful. And so they took a look at it and thought, sure. And it became their coffin table. Accommodated use, yeah, that worked okay. There even was a guy in San Antonio for a while who was making a coffin that you could use as a bookshelf in the meantime. So you would turn it on its end, turn it up like that, and there were shelves that you could slide in, and you could use it as a bookshelf, and then when you die, they just take the books out and put you in and bury you. Hey, is that practical or what? But it's an accommodated use. So you get the picture. There are conforming uses. We can pretty much predict that almost all coffins will be used to bury a body in. But you know, we can't be 100% certain that's what's going to happen. Human nature is not that way. We aren't totally predictable. There are certain implied uses that we could, that could well happen. And then there's certainly accommodated uses we couldn't even imagine, but in fact, that shape or form is flexible enough, it could do other things as well. So let me give you another example. This is one of my favorite examples of just studying space and configuration of space and use and behavior, and that is bathrooms in dormitories. What it's often referred to as a gang bathroom. Now, I'm not talking about if you have one of those shishi nice dormitories with, two bedrooms that share a single bath between, and it's a bath just like you have back in your house at home. I'm talking about a bathroom that accommodates, 8, 10, 12, 15 people, and has a number of toilets and a number of sinks and a number of showers. A dormitory bathroom of that sort. So how many of you have lived in a place or been in a place that has that kind of bathroom? Okay, a bunch of you. There are a bunch of those on campus. So think of one of those bathrooms. So conforming use, yep, pretty clear. Conforming use is, going to the bathroom, right? Like taking a leak, taking a whatever. Shower, that's a conforming use. Shaving in front of a mirror at a sink, that's a conforming use. Putting on your makeup, maybe, that's a conforming use. The thing is designed exactly for those things to happen there. But there are very powerful implied uses in one of those bathrooms. I lived in a dormitory my freshman year that had that kind of bathroom, and there were probably 25 or 30 guys, and this was a big bathroom that shared that bathroom. And it was the social center of the dormitory. That's where you saw everybody. I mean, you get up in the morning, you go in there to shave, you're doing this mindless activity. Next to you are two or three guys who are also doing the very same mindless activity. All of you have a lot in common. You're the same age. You're at the same university. And of course, you're going to sit there and talk. You're going to talk about all kinds of things. You're going to talk about how blasted you got last night. You're going to talk about this babe in my history class. I mean, you're going to talk about everything. It's just natural. That's the way human beings are. It's an implied use that is going to be a social interaction space. Standing there at the mirror in front of the sink, washing your face, shaving, doing whatever. You're going to have those implied uses. In this particular bathroom that I lived in, it was very long and skinny. It was a bizarre bathroom, super long and skinny. And it had, at one end of it, it had a whole series of sinks. And then in the middle, it had a whole series of urinals and toilets. And then it had a whole series of showers. And they were all just linear. And then there was a kind of passageway that linked them all together on one side. And of course, it's all made out of bathroom tile because, you know, there's water in there and, you know, that's what bathrooms are. So a bunch of guys on my hall decided that we were going to have the bathroom Olympics. And there were all kinds of little sports activities that they figured out in this bathroom. So what they would do is they would take the showers and they would turn them out to that passageway and get it all wet, get all the ceramic tile on the floor wet all the way up and down it. And then you would take like three leaps and, you know, bare ass, slide as far as you could along that floor. And then they would have markers for how far everybody could slide bare ass on that wet ceramic tile floor. And that, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, everybody would say, okay, bathroom Olympics time. And there were a number of other things like that. But because of its configuration, it accommodated, okay, accommodated this bizarre sports event that worked out there. Was that ever imagined by the architect? I'm certain it was not. But creative college students, you know, those things happen. I showed you earlier in the semester Morrison Stiles College by Eero Saarinen. We looked at it for its masonry, heavy masonry construction. I had friends who lived in that dorm at Yale while I was at MIT, and I'd go down and visit them. And one time when I was visiting them, they had this really cool party. Now, the way it worked in that dorm was there are kind of suites. So there'll be a stairwell like this, and off that stairwell on every floor, there'll be a series of living rooms on either side. And then off that living room, there are six bedrooms, a little hall that goes down to six bedrooms. And then off that hallway, there's a bathroom at the end. So it's stairwell, living room, bedrooms, bathroom. And then so that they don't have to have a second fire stair, they made a door between that bathroom and the next bathroom, where it repeated again, bathroom, bedrooms, living room, stairwell. So they just put a door between the two bathrooms. And it was meant to be an emergency exit, so that's your second means of egress in case of a fire. But in fact, what happened was you'd be living in this suite, and you'd realize, well, the suite right over there is where my buddy Jerry lives. I don't have to go through the hallway, through the living room, down the stairwell, outside, back around here, in his stairwell, through his living room to get to his room. I can just go freaking through the door of the bathroom to his bathroom, and his dorm room's right there. So people often just opened the door between those two bathrooms. And then because the bathroom was a kind of social center, the people in that bathroom got to know the people in the other bathroom right there, and so they'd all kibitz about. And then what happened was the people in these two bathrooms that adjoined each other, they decided they wanted to have a party together. Well, their living rooms, one was down here and the other was down here, and it's kind of hard to have a party that's that far apart. So they decided we'll just have the party in the bathroom. So they just opened up the bathroom, and there was like, they put the stereos in there. The sound was fantastic because of all that reverberant surface in a bathroom. You know, plenty of water for the bar right there, tons of sinks, plenty of places to sit down, you know, of a certain sort. And this party was happening in this double bathroom. And it was a very cool party. Again, an accommodated use. You know, who would have thought? But an accommodated use. Now, the point of all of this is that when we design environments, we can be fairly certain some things will happen there. And there are other things that we can provoke or encourage to happen there. But can we absolutely predict human behavior will be this way in that space? No. It's looser fit than that. It's not like a hand in a glove. It's more like a hand in a mitten. And other things are going to happen. Okay, so that's the premise, that architectural determinism, of course, the physical environment does determine many things about our social relationships, about our learning, about our healing, all of those things. Is it something we can completely predict? No, it's much looser fit than that. So we're going to look at a few environments here and the way in which they exercise that looser fit. And the first of these is just one of my favorite buildings on the face of the globe. And it's definitely a building I know backward, forward, upside down. The very first day I went away to college as a freshman, I slept in that dorm. I didn't end up getting assigned to that dorm. It kind of pissed me off because I really wanted to live there, but I didn't get the high enough number in the lottery. But I had friends that lived in this dorm the whole time I was an undergraduate. And then when I was a graduate student, I was a tutor in one of the dorms that was nearby it, so I followed it then. And then as a young professional, I was hired by MIT to do a study of their dormitory system and to see what was working, what wasn't working. And I did extensive interviews and focus groups and polls of the students in Baker House to try to understand exactly how this dorm worked. And one of the reasons why I spent so much time on it was this was the most popular dorm at MIT at the time. And it just seemed like it made everybody happy. So I wanted to know what is it that worked in that dorm. So this was designed by Alvar Aalto. That's him on the left at about, he was born in 1902. He did this building in 1949. This is him when he's in his mid-40s, about the same time he did the dorm. He was Finnish. He was actually teaching at MIT as a visiting professor and was a very famous architect at the time and was hired to do this dorm. Now, we're going to be looking at Aalto a good bit the next few lectures because this guy is all over human factors. He's one of those architects that just, this is the be-all, end-all. This is what really makes him excited about architecture, is affecting people's lives. And he's this very warm, sensitive human being who just, that was the highest priority for him. So it turns out this was done shortly after that study had been done by Festinger and Schachter on the married student housing on Briggs Field. And in fact, that married student housing, that's Briggs Field right there. The married student housing was a little farther down here. But during the time that Aalto was there and designing the dorm, all that study had just been done. And so he knew it. And he knew those people who were doing the study. And he was very intrigued by how can I apply those lessons in designing this dorm. So it's a dorm for 360 students. It originally was designed for 300 students. He had to add 60 rooms late in the game on this. It's right on the Charles River. The Charles River is right there. The MIT campus is back. That pathway takes you to 77 Mass Ave, which is the main entrance to the MIT campus. This is a big athletic field on that side. This is south here, that's north on that side. So it's long faces north and south, short faces east and west. A long thin site with a beautiful view of the Charles River and the skyline of Boston on the other side. And then the bitter cold winter wind off of Briggs Field on that side. Now we're in a slightly different climate than in Austin. In Boston, you want as much sun as you can get pretty much all year round. So all that south light would have been great. Also, west light is actually really good, especially in the wintertime when you want every bit of sun you can possibly get. So this is the Charles River, as you can see glimpsing right there. Memorial Drive, a beautiful parkway next to it. So the views are over the trees and to the blue water and off to the city. Here you can see from the terrace of the living room there, you can see the blue of the water and the skyline of Boston in the distance. Really, really great sight. And he was aware from day one, whoa. Part of this is just capitalizing on the character of that site. It basically has the dorm rooms in the red brick volume here, and then this precious little object made out of limestone that has the dining room on the lower floor and the living room on the upper floor that everybody shares at the kind of heart of that. And the top of that, because the students look down on it, it's made a very handsome roof. It's what the students call the moon garden. And it's very clever. These are skylights that give light down into the dining room and living room. but they've also got lamps so that the light, the artificial light, shines through the skylight. So you, when you turn the lights on, it comes the same way that the light comes from the sun. But also the heat from those lights melts the snow on the skylights so that in the wintertime, it automatically gets the snow off of the skylights and lets the light come through all year round. This is very interesting, his design process here. And I went back to Alvar Aalto's office in Helsinki and went through all of his drawers of drawings that he had produced for the building and found these drawings that were early in the process where he's thinking through, how should I configure this building ideally? And in the slides on the right, we see there were actually 12 of these drawings done. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We're going to show the other 6 in a minute. But he starts with saying, okay, I've got to get 300 rooms on this site. How can I get them in? And he's looking at these pluses and minuses. What are the advantages and disadvantages of each scheme? And he's looking in particular, if you can read up there, he's looking at sun, because sun in Boston is a big thing. He's looking at views, because you're on this gorgeous site. How is he maximizing the view? He's looking at privacy, because this is my dorm room. I'm going to be, you know, getting undressed, crawling into bed. You know, I want my privacy. So sun, view, and privacy are very important in looking at advantages and disadvantages. And he's also looking at the number of rooms he can pack on there, because it's a fairly dense configuration. And so he's always figuring out how many beds he can get. So at the beginning here, he's getting his 300 beds. That's a plus. But look, all these guys are looking smack into each other's windows. Crummy privacy. Most of them have east or west exposure, so no sun from the south. That's bad. And only a few of them could possibly get views of the Charles River. Most of them are looking into the other buildings. So, you know, bad view, bad sun, bad privacy. Then he's sliding them a little back and forth. He gets a little better view. He gets a little better sun. A little better privacy, but still not good. He does 3 instead of 4 to stretch them a little farther apart. Still not very good sun view or privacy. He starts canting the edges so that more people can get a view out. Yeah, it's kind of a view, but it also is kind of looking into the building next door still. Then he spreads them apart and puts another piece in there. That's improving. He's getting kind of medium view and medium privacy. He makes a longer building here, so a lot now nobody's looking into each other's windows. Some of them are looking up the river. Some of them are looking down the river. Some of them are looking across the river. Yeah, it's getting pretty good in view and in privacy. Still not great for sun, because a lot of these are looking east and west. But the one problem now is he's not getting as many beds as he needs, so it's too few beds, so that's a minus. Then he moves over here, he makes a long skin. Everyone gets a view, everyone gets the sun, and everyone has great privacy, but very few beds. So in the negative, he's got excellent sun view and privacy, crappy number of beds. So then he stretches it a little like this with angles. He gets a little better, but still too few beds. He makes it wiggle like crazy over here, and that's getting him more beds, still good sun view and privacy. Shapes it a slightly different way. Now we get all the beds in there, but now we're starting to have views into each other's rooms, so that's not so good. And so finally he gets this configuration that gets him excellent sun view and privacy and gets him his 300 beds. So he's optimizing the design by going through this elaborate analysis of these various parameters. Then he takes that general idea, he alters it a little, pulls a little flat piece out here. He's working now with how you'd enter the building. There's that living room and dining room. There's a music room and a recreational space and all those things. So the common things are right when you come in the door. So you see your friends doing those things as you distribute to the rest of the building. These are early sketches. The building didn't end up exactly like that at all, but you can see the ideas developing. And then finally, we get to this final plan of the building right there. There was an interim scheme in here where he had all 300 rooms facing south, all 300 rooms looking at the Charles River. And he actually had been, he'd been reading Mark Twain while he was living in the United States. He's trying to improve his English partly, but he also just loved Mark Twain. He's kind of a rural guy in Finland, so he really relates to the kind of rural values of Mark Twain. And there's a passage in one of Mark Twain's books where he talks about addressing the Mississippi. And he said, look, when you have a big river like the Mississippi, you don't look at the river across it like that. That's like disrespectful. You need to look at the river up the river or down the river, because the river is flowing. And the way to address a river is up the river or down the river. So instead of having views that were right straight across the Charles, he tends to make you look up the river or down the river. And then also by these kind of slow curves, you don't have that privacy violation. Everyone's looking out, but not looking into each other's windows. So he got all 300 rooms there, and then MIT came back to him and said, wait, we did our numbers calculation, and we can't make enough money out of 300 rooms. We need 360 rooms to make our numbers work. So he had to add 60 rooms at the last minute, or 60 beds, and he added them right here, which has West View, which also is a nice view down the Charles River. And the West light in Boston is a good light because you want that warming late afternoon light in the wintertime. So he gets all 360 beds in it, 60 essentially on each floor, six floors. Now, let's break down the social structure here. And this is freaking genius. I'm telling you, it's genius. So he's thinking about college life. Okay, MIT draws students from all over the country. Most students who come to MIT don't know anyone else in their freshman class. You know, maybe there's one or two other people from their high school, but basically they don't know anybody. So you dump all these students together, and honestly, you know, look, I'm an MIT grad, I can say this. It's a bunch of nerds. Jeez, socially inept. Many, many of them socially inept. So you're dumping a bunch of nerds in this place, and you're trying to get them to feel at home and feel comfortable and not psych out, you know, and go psycho weird on you. So you'd like for them to make friends and to, you know, bond with each other. So you're thinking, okay, you're a freshman coming here. What's it going to be like? So he says, okay, number one, we're going to have triple rooms for freshmen. Triples or doubles. Everybody's going to have roommates. So we're not going to let anybody hole up. If they're shy, if they're, you know, whatever, you can't do that. You're going to have to, you know, be in a room with other people. So most of these rooms over here are triples and doubles, and that's where the freshmen come in their first year. And then as they get to be sophomores, they might stay in a double if they wanted to have a roommate, or they might gravitate towards singles. But this tends to be the freshman and sophomore area with lots of triples and doubles all through there. And they share a living room right here. The hall just kind of bulbs out and becomes the living room. And that's the kind of social center for that whole wing. And there are about 25 students that live on that part, which is just the right size, so everybody knows each other, at least by face and by name. They've got their bathrooms here and here, those gang bathrooms for that 25 or 30 people. And that tends to be a really nice, tight unit. And so that's pretty much the freshman, sophomore end. There are few upperclassmen rooms, which are single rooms, and sometimes the upperclassmen like to live on that end and be the big dog and you know, share their calculus homework that they did well on with the freshmen who are trying to do their calculus homework. And you know, and actually that works out really well. They end up being kind of mentors. So that's sort of freshman, sophomore area. Then as you get here, they get to be single rooms. And there are 16 different kinds of room in Baker House, and each of them has a name. So they refer to them as a pie single, or a reverse pie single, or a coffin single, you know, by the shape of that room. And as you get, and they have lotteries for what room you want to be in. And people generally in their early years, they're in the triples and doubles. And then as they get priority, they get in the singles that are through here. So this tends to be juniors and seniors. And in the MIT context, whatever dorm you live in your freshman year, you're going to live there all 4 years. It's very difficult to get housing in the rest of Cambridge, was certainly at the time, still is, and super expensive. So people tend to stay in on-campus housing. And so this allowed people to have different experience their freshman, sophomore year than they had their junior and senior year. By the time you get to a senior, you might be down here at this kind of dead end down here. Not many people go by. You've got your single room. You're, you know, doing your thesis. You're nerding it up big time, you know, just serious student, and maybe not so social. That's fine. You're a senior. You've been through all this. Whatever. Your choice. Maybe you got your own friends that you deal with. So 60 people on a floor. About 25 there, about another 15 or 20 here, about another 15 or 20 here. Each of those groups has a living room, has their bathroom. There's a kind of continuous flow between them. It's not like there's a door and there's a barrier. All 60 people are on the same floor. They're a kind of unit like that. But there also is this kind of differentiation as you go along. Totally sensitive to this social structure. So it's very likely as a freshman, you're going to have freshman, sophomore, junior, senior on your floor that you can get to know and, you know, just get a sense of what the whole college experience is going to be like. For the juniors and seniors, they have certain levels of privacy that's a little different than this more raucous area down there. Everybody seems to sort things out just right. So There is a Baker House t-shirt that they've had for many years that's in the shape of the building. It spells out Baker in the shape of the building. It's a weird t-shirt. But I'd seen it when I was a student there. And then, I don't know, 20, 25 years later, I see this guy in Gregory Gym. I'm teaching here. It's a guy in Gregory Gym with a Baker House t-shirt. Yeah, you don't see many of those in Austin, Texas. So I go up to him and said, you know, so do you live in Baker House? Where'd you get the t-shirt? And he said, I lived in Baker House for 4 years. And it turned out he had been an undergraduate in chemistry at MIT, and then he went all the way through PhD in chemistry at MIT, and he was doing a postdoc here at UT. And so I got to talking to him about Baker House, and I swear, I was not provoking this. The guy just stands there in Gregory Gym, and he tells me, Baker House changed my life. He said, when I was a freshman, I was from a small town in the Midwest. I was really, really smart, but I was totally socially inept. I had already decided that I would go away to MIT. I knew I would not make any friends because I didn't know how to make friends. I would just study really hard, and I would just be lonely. And I was just resigned to that was going to be my life. At MIT, and I was buckled under to do it. And I was scared shitless. I mean, it was petrifying to go away from my family, who I was really close to, and go into this brand new place. So he said, I got assigned to one of those triple rooms, and I was really horrified. I thought, this is terrible. I don't know how to talk to these people. I don't know how to get to know them. This is super uncomfortable. I've always had my own bedroom. I've always had my own bathroom. This is a violation of my privacy. But he said, you know, in the very first few days, he realized these other two guys who are my roommates, they are just like me. They feel just like me. And the three of them bonded immediately and just said, hey, we're each other's friends. This is great. And then, you know, he met other guys in the bathroom, in the lounge, you know, at that end of the hall, and got to know them, and it was easy to make friends. It was natural to make friends. He didn't have to know how. It just worked for him to make friends with these people because he had a lot in common with them. And he said, I lived on that same floor of Baker House all 4 years. I did the classic thing of gravitating freshman, sophomore year down here, senior year holed up in the other end down there doing my thesis in chemistry. I was a very serious student, but I also had a great time. He said, I even freaking learned to date girls. Hey, you know, like, who'd have believed that? Me, total nerd. But, you know, there were guys who kind of helped me out, fixed me up, you know, went to mixers with them, watched what they did. And, you know, it was great. So I said, dude, you have got to come to my class and tell my students about your experience in Baker House. And for 3 years while he was a postdoc here, he came to my class every semester, and I can still see him standing at the back of the room, sweating bullets, because getting up in front of 300 people and telling this story was hard for him. And I told him, dude, this is good for you. You need to figure out how to do this. So he would stand back there sweating, petrified, and then he'd come down here and he would just tell people what I just told you, that this building changed my life. It totally taught me how to make friends. And if I had not ended up in a building like this, my life would have been different. So that's the kind of difference, you know, a well-designed environment that is really alert to these factors can make. So off of each of those six floors, you go on to the stairwell. The stairwell is not your normal fire stair, which when you think about it is a dumb way to design a stair because you're wrapping around like that. But when you're on that stair, you can't see anybody else who's on the stair. And he wants a social environment in the stair. So he makes this cascading stair where when you walk out on the sixth floor and somebody else walks out on the fourth floor, you see him and say, hey, Joe, you going to the campus? Hold up, I'll walk with you. And it's a friendly stair, and it's got glass, it's got windows. It's not like you're in the cellar. And all those stairs then cascade down to this central entry. When you go in the building, you go up the stair into the various floors. Right inside that front door is that living room and dining room. You go in at the living room level, you go down the stairs to the dining room level. You have these beautiful views of the Charles River. It's very enticing to just stay there, hang out, go out on the terrace if it's nice weather. The ritual of dining there was very well established by the building. You would go in the dining hall downstairs, you would have your meal, and then they always had coffee after dinner. And you had coffee after dinner up on this terrace of the living room there, and outside sometimes, inside sometimes. They would invite faculty members. I was so jealous of the people who lived in Baker House. They invited faculty members, and the faculty members would be there for coffee after dinner. And there was just always this very civilized interaction. You know, dinner was like an hour, hour and a half. It wasn't like breeze in there, you know, feed your face and leave. It was, you know, you sat around, you had a conversation at the table with your friends, then you gravitate up, you have coffee, you talk with maybe a faculty member who's visiting that day or just your buddies, you go out on the terrace. That was just what everybody did because it was beautiful. It was a great place to do it. So this is the difference between really beautifully designed environments for human interaction and just normal design. So here, the architectural character of the building has everything to do with all these issues. I mean, that curve, it's not like he said, whoa, I'm Frank Gehry, I'm gonna do like wild ass curves. Nah, that curve, he didn't do very many curves, and he didn't do curves in other buildings. It worked here because he needed the perimeter to get that view and get that sun and to get that privacy he needed in the building. Every single person has a window like that, and their desk is normally under the window, so you get good light on your desk by the window. And that big facade out in front is a collection of every single individual in there has a kind of representation on that facade. And then these banks of windows are those living rooms off that freshman sophomore wing, and the bathrooms get their kind of window that's much more about privacy, and you can read all the functions of the building right straight through on the architectural character of the building. Okay, amazing, amazing building. Now, shortly after that, just down the river, that's Baker House, and just down the river, MIT then built what they called new houses. And it was called New House for a long time. I think they finally got some other names for it. But in a way, they were doing something that would be complementary to Baker House. They didn't duplicate it. Some people, it turns out, wanted smaller living groups. 360 people was a little daunting. Going down to dinner for 360 people, a little daunting. So they built another dorm for 360 people, but they divided it into six small dorms, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And each of them has an architectural identity. And they also have, you know, it looks a little like one of those schemes that Aalto rejected, but they do have nice views of the river, and they have these courtyards that open out to the river. And then there's a spine that connects the ground floor of all six houses. And on the ground floor of those, they have, different houses have different things. Some of them have a big living room. Some of them are more about cooking, and they have a bigger dining room. One of them is French house, one of them is German house, where you only speak that language in that house. They've got very, you know, specific differences between them. On that ground floor is some place where the students can cook for themselves, not little kitchens holed up in by their rooms, but down below, and they're like clusters of four or five little kitchens. So people can cook in the little kitchen, and then they can eat together, but they can cook their own food as opposed to using the dining room food, which you have in Baker House. And that long kind of concourse that connects all of them together, and these nice courtyards that connect them together. So it's a very different lifestyle. Not better, not worse. Very different than in Baker House. And MIT was cognizant of the fact Baker House is fantastic. It's super successful. Is it exactly right for everyone? No, we need some variety. And they switched it up a few years later when they built New House. Now, this is what I think is the most deterministic environment I have ever seen. This is a monastery in France near Lyon called La Tourette. This is done by Le Corbusier, who we've talked about many times before. This was done for the Dominican Order. The Dominican Order of Catholic Priests is an order that normally is urban, and they're normally kind of do-gooders. They're very integrated in the community. And they're not normally cloistered monks. But they decided in the 1960s to have this experiment and to see what it would be like to have one small piece of their order that was cloistered. A cloistered monk is someone who takes themselves away from everyone else and has their life with God. So instead of me interacting with other human beings, I'm meant to only interact with God. I'm here alone with God. So this is a building that is not about humans interacting together, but everyone actually feeling isolated and connected to God. So it's out in the middle of the countryside, away from the city. It, in fact, is a kind of bastion that is separated from the environment around it. All of the rooms are placed way up high. All of the rooms are up here. The whole building, in fact, is completely detached from the ground. The ground just kind of slides through here, and the building is kind of up on piers. And in fact, these people never go out of the building. They just stay in there. There are servants who bring food in and feed them. When the thing was originally there, if you were a family member, you could only visit in a very, very limited period of time. And it isn't like people could have their friends over or anything like that. It was strictly, this is an environment for the monks. And they're meant to be there 24/7, and they're there just to commune with God. So it's a very extreme environment. If they did have visitors, there are these three little pods right there where the visitors would come and the monks would come down from their room and they would just greet them right there. But the visitors couldn't go in the rest of the monastery and the monks didn't leave the monastery. And it operated this way for almost 20 years. And I first visited La Tourette at the very end of that period. They were still cloistered monks, but they didn't have such hard and fast rules about that. But all of them had a cell, so on those upper floors, every monk has a tiny little room. Those rooms are really narrow. I can touch both walls when I stretch my arms out. And it's just a little closet, a little sink, a bed, and a desk. Very, very austere. And then on other floors, there is a library where they can study. There's a refectory where they eat. But when I went there and they were still in their cloistered mode, there was silence in the refectory. So you would sit there and no one said anything to anyone else. You could just hear the silverware clink, but it was totally silent. There's a courtyard in the center of the whole thing. It has these little chapels that spill out into it. There's a walkway around that courtyard, very, very austere, solid concrete all the way around. And in fact, you know, part of being a monk is this notion of circumambulation, so you walk around. But they would walk on the roof, and there was this wall around where they walked, so you couldn't see out. You can't see out to anywhere from inside. In fact, in this corridor, that's all their monks' rooms there. At the end, there's a window, but it has a concrete baffle in front of it. So the light comes in, but you can't see out. And right there, this is an extremely low ceiling, and that's like below my eye level. It's about right here. So you actually, the idea is you don't see out. You get the light functionally, so it's not dark, but you're not meant to look at the outside. You're not meant to be tempted by what's out there. The one place where it's gorgeous is the chapel. That's where you're communing with God. And it's huge space, very high reverberation. The sound is phenomenal in there. You can hear yourself breathing in there. It's so reverberant. And when the monks do their chants, it's spooky, spooky, beautiful sound. But this extremely, extremely strong environment that is meant to make you isolated from everyone else, but then me, at a certain point, connected to God. And there's a place here where all of the monks would do individual masses, and their ritual would be there, and they're not doing it for a congregation or a church. It's just a single monk with that skylight connecting them to God in this very emotional environment. Now, I will lay you big odds. If you lived in a cloistered way in La Tourette Monastery for 5 years, it would completely change who you were as a human being. It would make you think about the world in a different way, and that's exactly what the point was. Okay, I'm a little late. No Twitter card question today. I'll see you on Thursday.